From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, new developments in saving the lives of extremely premature babies. We'll talk with two authors of the new book, Preemies, Donna Wexler Linden, who gave birth to premature twins, and her sister, Dr. Mia Wexler Duran, a neonatologist. Also, new research on prenatal development. We talk with Dr. Peter Nathaniels about how the physical and hormonal interactions between a mother and the developing baby in her womb affect the child's future health and well-being. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Rackets, a new novel by Thomas Kelly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. North Carolina Senator Jesse Helms is expected to announce his retirement tomorrow. The Raleigh News and Observer says Helms has decided not to seek a sixth term next year. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Senator Helms is 79 years old and is suffering from a nerve disorder that makes it difficult for him to walk. In part because of his health, the conservative elder statesman is expected to announce he will not run for re-election in 2002. North Carolina Republican Party Chairman Bill Coby calls Helms a man of principle who won't be easily replaced.
You couldn't recreate Senator Helms. He's a very significant figure, not only in North Carolina politics, but in national and international politics.
Already, potential candidates are lining up to take Helms' place. Among the Republicans who may run is Elizabeth Dole, the former cabinet secretary, who's a North Carolina native. The only Democrat in the race so far is North Carolina Secretary of State Elaine Marshall. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Raleigh, North Carolina.
According to a report released by NASCAR today, Dale Earnhardt's broken seatbelt was one of many factors that contributed to his death. The six-month investigation found the seatbelt, the collision with another car, and the angle of impact in which Earnhardt hit the wall all played a role in the crash. NASCAR says next season it will install devices similar to airplane flight data recorders to help understand the physics of crashes and to try to improve car safety. A $1 billion tire deficit defect lawsuit against Bridgestone Firestone went to jury in Texas today. A Texas family sued the tire maker after the rollover of the family's Ford Explorer when the tire shredded. During closing arguments today, lawyers for the family said the tire maker lied about the safety of the tires, but attorneys for Bridgestone Firestone asked the jury to hold Ford Motor Company completely responsible. Stock prices fell sharply today following another quarter-point rate cut by the Federal Reserve. The NASDAQ Composite Index fell more than 2%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 1.5% of its value. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Fed policymakers decided to cut short-term interest rates for a seventh time this year. The federal funds rate was reduced from 3.75% to 3.5%, its lowest rate in 7 years. The discount rate was also cut to 3%. The cuts were about in line with Wall Street's expectations, but stock prices plummeted anyway, and some analysts pointed to an essentially gloomy statement about economic prospects that the Fed released. The statement said the economy continues to struggle with a big drop in business capital spending and weakness overseas. The statement leaves open the possibility of another rate cut this year, perhaps at the October meeting of Fed policymakers. The Fed did have encouraging words about consumer spending, saying household demand continues to be sustained. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
At the close, the Dow was off 146 points and the NASDAQ was down 50. You're listening to NPR News. The world's largest internet and media company said today it'll cut more than 1,200 jobs. AOL Time Warner said the cuts will be felt at its AOL Internet unit. The firm will take a third-quarter charge of $100 million. The unit employs about 16,000 people. Company officials also said the firm will eliminate 500 jobs as part of an alliance between Netscape and Sun Microsystems. The move marks the third round of layoffs at the company after the completion of its $106 billion merger in January. The Army is deploying soldiers to help with firefighting efforts in the Northwest. Officials are hoping forecasters' predictions of rain for tonight prove true. From member station KUOW, Patricia Murphy reports.
Firefighters have made some progress battling several large fires. Officials are reporting that a 6,100-acre fire 5 miles north of Brewster, Washington, is 95% contained, and the 7,200-acre Icicle Creek fire near Leavenworth has grown little since yesterday. However, a 4,300-acre blaze in the Wenatchee National Forest is still raging out of control, and the more than 40 wildfires burning in the West have stretched resources to the limit. 600 soldiers from Fort Lewis are getting a crash course in firefighting to offer relief to professional crews on the front lines. More than 1,000 soldiers will be deployed in stages later this week. Forecasters are predicting rain for the next few days, but the weather may be of little help. The precipitation will likely just dampen things a bit. For NPR News, I'm Patricia Murphy in Seattle.
A lawyer for one of two Philadelphia businessmen charged in a deadly nightclub pier collapse says his client denies any wrongdoing. A grand jury says the pier owner and nightclub owner were warned just hours before the tragedy. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A woman who gives birth to a very premature baby is in for a very different experience than she'd planned. Rather than nursing and snuggling her baby, the baby is likely to be taken to a neonatal intensive care unit with new technologies which have made it possible for premature babies to survive in greater numbers than ever before. My guest, Donna Wexler Linden, is a former senior editor at Forbes magazine. She gave birth to premature twins and had to quickly learn about the medical options posed by the new technologies. She had the help of her sister, Dr. Mia Wexler Duran, a neonatologist at the Newborn Critical Care Center at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The sisters are two of the authors of the new book, Preemies. It's a guide for parents of premature babies. We asked Donna Wexler Linden to share her story and Dr. Mia Wexler Duran to explain new medical developments in the field. I asked Linden if she was expecting a premature birth.
No, it came as a total surprise. What happened was that at 25 weeks, I had slight premature labor pains, and on examination had a slightly dilated cervix and was hospitalized on just sort of routine bed rest. And in the middle of the night one night, my water broke, which just a day or two later, so I was still at 25 weeks, and that meant that it was inevitable or almost inevitable that I would give birth at any time, and it was just a terrifying waiting game to try to get every additional day I could for the babies in the womb. And I got about 2 more weeks before they were born.
Donna, did you see your babies as soon as they were born?
I did. And they were, it was scary, but they were fully formed. Now, to me, in retrospect, beautiful babies. I can't say I thought that at the time because they're just too tiny and too red and... but all the fingers and toes were there, and they were beautiful little bodies. But I was terrified, and I saw them for just a second or two, and I remember the obstetrician saying, "These are the healthiest-looking 27-week babies I've ever seen," and of course that provided some relief. And then they were, within minutes, whisked away to the intensive care unit.
How big were they? Compare them to, say, the size of your hand.
They would fit in it. They were each 2 pounds, or one of them was a few ounces over 2 pounds, and the other was 2 pounds. And they would fit in the palm of an adult male hand.
Were their eyes developed enough for them to be able to open their eyes?
Yes, they could open their eyes. In fact, one of the most moving things for me was when I finally got over my fear, which took me the better part of a day, and went down to the intensive care unit to see them. I looked at, I think it was Maya, actually, who's my surviving daughter, and she looked right up at me and with a really, you know, holding my gaze, and it was very moving. So, of course, eyesight isn't very good, but their eyes were fully open and able to see.
Were they able to breathe on their own?
At first, Maya was ventilated, put on a ventilator almost immediately. because she was struggling to breathe on her own. She came out crying and gasping for breath, which is great, but she wasn't able to breathe well enough and to maintain her health. So she was put on a ventilator immediately. Ellie, who's my baby who died, was actually the one who seemed to be stronger at first. And she wasn't put on a ventilator at first, but then deteriorated somewhat, and after about a day was put on a ventilator.
Dr. Duran, is it typical that preemies have to be put on a ventilator in order to breathe?
It depends on how young the preemie is, how immature their lungs are, for one, because immature lungs have a hard time taking in enough oxygen and getting rid of enough carbon dioxide to maintain the normal functioning of the body. But there are other immaturity reasons why a premature baby may need to be on a ventilator. The breathing center in their brains are often not fully mature. So while they might breathe well for a while, they'll have pauses where the brain just doesn't give their body the signal to breathe. And so if those pauses go on too long, obviously that's unhealthy. And also their chest walls, the cartilage and the muscles are weak. And so oftentimes they have a hard time keeping their lungs fully expanding and actually making strong breathing movements. So all of those immaturities together make it more likely for younger preemies to need the help of a breathing machine than for older ones.
Donna, when your twins were born, were they put in incubators? What kind of incubators were they put in?
Their first beds in the neonatal intensive care unit were open beds under warmers, which kept their bodies warm. The reason is that they were very medically unstable at that point, and a lot of things were being done to them medically, intravenous lines being put in and ventilators being put in and watched, and all kinds of monitoring and testing taking place. And so rather than having them in an incubator, which would make it harder for the doctors and nurses to get to them, they were on what's called a warming bed. And I think that, unfortunately, Ellie never actually made it into an isolette, or she did, I guess, for one day. But Maya moved into an isolette when she was more stable after about 5 or 6 days.
Dr. Duran, is the goal in the isolette or, you know, the warming bed, is the goal to simulate a womb-like atmosphere?
No, unfortunately, I wish we were better at simulating womb-like atmospheres. The main goal of an isolette is to keep the baby warm, because a premature baby can't maintain his or her own body temperature, both because they don't have the layers of fat that are needed for insulation, and also because that's another part of their brain that's not mature, which is the temperature regulating part. So they need some help. The other reason that an isolette is used is to enclose the baby. Part of what makes a baby cold are changes in airflow. So by keeping the baby in a box, then the wind currents don't go by them and cool them off. But also it protects them a little bit, not a great deal, but a little bit from infection as well.
You mentioned that sometimes babies are given a cellophane blanket. It's basically like cellophane wrap. Why is that used?
Yeah. Well, that's only for the very smallest babies, the ones who are not in isolettes. This is used for babies who are still under radiant warmers, which are those open beds with a heating source from above that we use when we need to have an extremely good and complete view of the baby at all times, and also need very quick and easy access to a baby in case we have to intervene medically. But at the same time that we need the baby sort of out there in the open, really, really immature babies have very thin skin that doesn't hold in their vital fluids very well. And so as in an attempt to keep them from losing so much body water, we cover them with cellophane. It sounds a little crass, but the way you would try and keep a sandwich from drying out, if you have cellophane around the baby, then more fluid can stay inside.
My guests are neonatologist Dr. Mia Wexler-Duran and her sister, Donna Wexler-Linden, who gave birth to premature twins. They are two of the authors of the new book, Preemies. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about premature babies, and my guests are the co-authors of the new book, Preemies. It's a guide for parents of premature babies. Donna Wexler-Linden is the mother of a baby who was born premature. Actually, she had twins. One of her daughters died. She's a former senior editor of Forbes magazine. Her sister, Dr. Mia Wexler-Duran, is a neonatologist at the Newborn Critical Care Center at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. On the average, what's the youngest preemie who's likely to pull through?
Nowadays, in this country, and that means with the very best high technological neonatal care, the youngest preemie that most people would consider to be potentially viable would be a baby born at 23 weeks of gestation. Now, every once in a while, you'll hear an anecdotal report of a 22-week baby surviving, but it's unclear whether, one, that baby was truly 22 weeks and how reliable those reports are. But currently, the accepted lower limit of viability is 23 weeks of gestation.
Donna, your babies were born at 27 weeks. What kind of technology were they hooked up to?
Oh, a lot. It was a disturbing sight. They were both on ventilators, so essentially they had a tube going down their mouths and down their airways to their lungs, and that was hooked up to breathing machines that gave them oxygen and pressure to keep their lungs breathing. At first, Maya and Ellie both had intravenous lines going into almost every limb, and they had a lot of different monitors on them connected to wires, which were connected to machines that made sure that they continued to breathe at the right rate, that their heartbeat was stable, that their oxygenation was stable, and that their temperature was stable. So all over their bodies were these various monitors. And if any of them faltered, loud alarms would go off. And that happened quite a bit, as is true for any preemie. It's very scary for the parents, but the nurses know how to deal with it. They also, because they had intravenous lines going into their arms, and there's a risk that through movement they'll dislodge them, they had splints on both their arms to try to keep their arms stable.
It must have been horrifying for you to see them like this.
It was definitely horrifying. I remember, again, it was my first trip down there to the NICU, as the neonatal intensive care unit is referred to as. And I went with Mia because she came up to New York, where I gave birth, from North Carolina when it was clear that I was about to give birth. And I was very scared to go down there and see. And when I got there, oh, it is, you know, just the worst thing that a parent could ever see, their baby like that. And I felt faint, and it didn't, you know, I was just woozy. And Mia said, "Donna, she looks great." and I thought that she was from Mars, but it was extremely encouraging. And of course, what she meant was, for a 27-week preemie, she looks great. She looks just the way she should be, and that's a good sign.
And Dr. Mia Duran, you're used to seeing babies like that, so it wasn't horrifying. It was just typical to you.
Exactly. And I think one of the things that we tend to, we, the doctors and nurses who work in intensive care nurseries, we forget how strange and extraordinary and horrifying these babies hooked up to all this equipment can look to their parents. And one of the things that I learned after writing the book and talking so much to Donna is when I talk to parents and show them their babies and tell them what's going on is to say things like, you know, here she is on the ventilator, here's what it's doing, and that's good, you know, or she looks healthy. And just really translate what may be obvious to us but not so at all to parents.
Let me tell you something I can't understand. When you see somebody on a ventilator, it looks so intrusive and so painful, and you're sure that if the tube is pulled out, it's going to scratch or maybe damage the tubes, you know, the mm-hmm. pipes in your body that it had been thrust into. When you're talking about a baby whose skin is barely developed, isn't it damaging to stick those through those tubes down their windpipe?
Well, the answer is yes and no. The yes part is that always it's more damaging to need to be on a ventilator and to have the injury, even if it's small, from the tube, and even more injurious is actually the force of the ventilator pushing the air into the very fragile air sacs. That does indeed cause small and sometimes large damage to the tissues. So that is worse than if you don't need it. But if you need it, the alternative is not getting enough oxygen in, which is actually even more damaging to tissues because the cells start to die if they don't get enough oxygen. But you're right, Terry. It's the quicker that we can get a baby off a ventilator, the better.
Donna, when your two babies were hooked up to all this technology shortly after they were born, I know it was very painful for you to watch them. You must have been worried that they were in a lot of pain too because they were attached to a ventilator and they had all these monitors and other kind of invasive things happening. Did you have any way of really knowing if they were in pain?
No, and I worried about it tremendously, and I asked about it a lot. And the nurses in general said, oh, they won't remember a thing. I remember quite a few nurses saying that to me, and I didn't find it very reassuring, number one, because I didn't want them to be feeling pain at the time, even if they were going to forget it later. And also, I was skeptical as to what that meant, that they wouldn't remember. And I know for us with Maya, we wondered for a long time how that experience had affected her. There was a lot, for sure, even if she rested comfortably some of the time, there was a lot of pain that normal full-term babies don't feel. There were a lot of medical procedures performed on her every day, that some of which were painful or uncomfortable, and there was a lot of disruption compared to what other babies go through. And we wondered for a really long time, and as she got older, she's now 5, but when she was a toddler, she was extremely clingy. She found being out of sight of us or even out of our arms very difficult. And at night, she used to scream out, I can't be alone, I can't be alone. And we wondered, did that have something to do with the experience? But of course, no one can answer the question. We went back to the hospital at one point after she had been home for about a month. We had to go back to the hospital for some tests. And she wasn't a fussy baby, a fussy infant, once she was at home. She was actually, she didn't cry all that much. When we got back to the hospital, she started sobbing violently, so much so. And she continued. We were there for a couple of hours, and she never stopped sobbing the entire time we were at the hospital, so that the test results were basically invalidated. And when we left the hospital and got into a taxi to go home, she stopped crying. And it may have been completely coincidence. In fact, probably it was completely coincidence. But you can't help but wonder whether she associated the smells or sounds or sight of the place with pain.
Dr. Duran, do you have any insights as a doctor about how much pain preemies feel when they're being exposed to these invasive procedures and how much that pain stays with them psychologically? Whether they remember it or not, it could still affect them psychologically.
I don't have too many insights into the latter question because there just hasn't been enough research into that. I can tell you that on the good side, there is not a higher incidence of psychiatric problems in former preemies, and there is not a higher incidence of severe social problems in preemies. So in terms of deep emotional scars, at least by those two measures, it would indicate that these babies are resilient. In terms of the pain that a baby feels at the time, certainly we know that premature babies can feel pain, and there are several studies now that indicate that they probably can feel it more intensely even than older babies because some of the pain dampening mechanisms are not mature, or they mature later than the pain sensing mechanisms.
Can you give preemies mini doses of painkillers?
You can, and actually what the problem for us as doctors is that it's like we sort of go between a pop gun and a cannon. We know that for babies, preemies included, certain very benign things are actually analgesic. They have pain alleviating properties. Sucking on a pacifier actually decreases pain in a baby. Tasting or sucking on sugar water decreases pain. And being swaddled in a blanket decreases pain. So we can do that, and those are not going to hurt any baby. But then we go from that to something like opiate narcotics. So we use morphine, and we actually use it fairly liberally, most neonatologists do, morphine or fentanyl, which is a synthetic opiate. And these are very powerful pain medications with some significant side effects. And the reason we don't use them even more is that we worry that the reason these medications work to alleviate pain is that they change nerve impulse transmission in the brain or how nerve impulses are received. Well, over time, that can also change brain development. And right now, we just don't have enough scientific information to tell us what the right balance is to strike.
Dr. Mia Wexler-Duran and her sister Donna Wexler-Linden will be back in the second half of the show. They're two of the authors of the new book, Preemies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Life in the Womb. We talk with Dr. Peter Nathaniels about how the interactions between a pregnant woman and the developing baby in her womb can affect the child's long-term health. Also, we continue our conversation about preemies, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews The Rackets by Thomas Kelly. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about new developments in saving the lives of very premature babies. My guests are two of the authors of the new book, Preemies, a guide for parents of premature babies. Donna Wexler Linden gave birth to premature twins. Her sister, Dr. Mia Wexler Duran, is a neonatologist at the Newborn Critical Care Center at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. She works with the new technologies that help preemies continue to develop outside the womb. Dr. Duran, you mentioned that the brains of preemies develop differently once they're outside the womb. What are the differences?
Well, one of the differences which we've just learned about recently is that certain parts of the brain in preemies are not as large as in full-term babies, and we don't know exactly what that means. It's an anatomic finding. We also know that preemies have a higher risk of bleeding in the brain, and many of them do have small and sometimes large bleeds, which can then affect the growth and the existence of nerves in the areas where they're bleeding. And then we also know that they have often a very high incidence of subtle learning and other neurological dysfunction that is probably indicative of some either injuries or different patterns of maturation.
Terry, there are some doctors and psychologists who believe that it may be possible to lessen the differences in preemie's brain development by adopting different practices in the intensive care unit. There's a field called developmental care, which is being applied in more and more intensive care units. And what it does is to try to make the neonatal intensive care unit more womb-like in any ways that it can. So, for example, some years ago, no one worried about the fact that in NICUs there were bright lights shining down on the babies all day and all night. Of course, it's not so light in the womb, and there are the baby gets regular sleep cycles, which are important for brain development. So now more and more hospitals are either covering the isolettes with blankets or other isolette covers to give the babies some darkness to let them sleep and be soothed by that, or dimming the lights at night. And sound is another big one. If we think that the womb is a relatively quiet place, and the NICU is a deafeningly loud place for a baby. In fact, studies have shown that just the act of placing a tiny preemie bottle on top of an isolette is the same decibel level for a baby as a lawnmower going off next to them or being an industrial factory. And that's what they hear all the time, and the alarms going off. So the advocates of developmental care are trying to get better noise control, asking people not to play radios and to speak quietly, and also to let the baby sleep longer by clustering caregiving so that instead of doing a heel prick for a medical test on a baby and then maybe 15 minutes later coming to feed them and maybe 15 minutes after they've finished a meal, changing their diaper or something, clustering those things so that in between they can have long periods of sleep. So all of these things are sort of slight and gradual changes that are taking place in the units, and some people think that they'll make a big difference in the brains.
Donna, were you able to touch or hold your babies after they were born, you know, in the days that they were in the hospital?
Yes, to different degrees. With Maya, who was our healthier baby, who survived, I could hold her, I think, after just about 3 days. It was scary at first. You know, you have a lot of wires to juggle and IV needles you want to be sure you don't pull out. But the nurse would take Maya out of the isolette and place her in my arms. And we would put a little visor on her head to shield her eyes from the light so she could look in my eyes. And it was a wonderful experience. And then not long after that, after she was off all breathing assistance, I started doing something called kangaroo care, which is basically holding your baby skin to skin against your chest. Kangaroo babies are born premature, and they develop outside the womb, or do a lot of their developing outside the womb after they're born. Anyway, this is done by more and more mothers now in neonatal intensive care units. It feels great to a mother. To me, it did. And one gets the sense that it feels great to a baby. So I spent 3 or 4 hours every day in the hospital doing that with Maya. With Ellie, she was so sick, and she never really could be picked up until we knew that she was dying and efforts stopped being made to keep her alive, and at which point I did hold her. But before that, really all I could do was to give her my finger, and she would grasp it. And when she was healthier, she had a really strong grasp, and as she got sicker, she didn't.
What happened to her?
What happened was that one night in the middle of the night, she developed what's called a pneumothorax, a tiny little tear in her lung. Perhaps, although one doesn't know, it was from the pressures of the ventilator. And they treated that exactly the way pneumothoraxes are treated, with a little tube in the chest. And then she had a second pneumothorax a few days later. And then it became clear that perhaps around the time of the pneumothorax, because blood pressure in a baby can fluctuate very violently at a time like when that happens, perhaps at that time she had a bleed in her brain, the kind that Mia was talking about, but it was a very severe one. And so she became sicker and sicker and sicker. And that's it. That was it. We knew about a day before she died that she wasn't going to make it, and so we were able to hold her without the tubes for a while until she died.
When it looked like both of your babies might pull through, did you worry that if they did live, they might be so physically, emotionally, or psychologically damaged by all the high-tech procedures they were going through that it would be a difficult life for them?
I did. I worried about it a lot. Mia was very helpful to me. The statistics were helpful to some extent because they were 27-weekers, and most 27-weekers pull through just fine. Ellie was in the minority, and so that helped. But I didn't eat for weeks. You know, I felt abnormal in my extreme reactions, and it took me a long time to realize that what's normal for parents of preemies is to feel despair and terror and a lot of pain and a lot of guilt, all of which I felt. But the psychological part, it's really amazing. I don't think it was until Maya was about 3 years old that I started to realize she was going to be okay. Every time she got a cold, I thought, well, this is the other shoe dropping.
Well, I imagine it's terrifying to take a baby home who's, you know, a preemie who's been in the hospital under 24-hour surveillance with all these high-tech monitors, and suddenly you're there alone with them, and you're probably afraid that they're going to not make it.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And actually, Maya came home twice, unfortunately. She didn't at first make it at home, in a way. She stopped breathing 3 days later. She turned blue, and we rushed her back to the hospital, and she was put right back on a ventilator again. We think she got some kind of infection at home, although we have no idea why or from where. When she came back the next time, she came home with a monitor, which a lot of preemies, not most, but some, go home with. And she had that connected to her for about 6 months all night. And that allowed me to sleep because I knew that if there was no alarm going off, she was okay. And in the first year, I sort of, especially after she had the incident when she first came home and stopped breathing, I wanted to watch her all the time to make sure that didn't happen again. But after that, again, partly because of writing the book and having Mia as my sister giving me advice on this, I knew that there is a dangerous syndrome that can develop, which has been dubbed vulnerable child syndrome, with parents being overly protective and hurting their child as a result because of their early vulnerability. And I really fought hard against that. I don't know if I was successful or not. It was a matter of hiding my own feelings of protectiveness. But I think we did okay.
Dr. Duran, as a neonatologist, what is the most amazing thing you see on a typical basis now?
To me, the most amazing thing is we have reunions every year of the graduates of our nursery. And the most amazing thing to me is to see a baby so tiny and so sick and barely looking like any baby that you would know. And then the next time I see that person, they're absolutely beaming, smiling, running around, and indistinguishable from any other child. So I think the success stories are so striking and so amazing now.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
Donna Wexler-Linden and Dr. Mia Wexler-Duran are two of the authors of the new book, Preemies. Coming up, life in the womb and how it affects the long-term health and well-being of the child. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dr. Peter Nathaniels, is the director of the Laboratory for Pregnancy and Newborn Research at Cornell University. He's researching how a pregnant woman's diet, stress level, and hormonal changes affect her developing baby's long-term health and well-being. Dr. Nathaniels is the author of the new book, The Prenatal Prescription. He claims that fetal programming is at least as important as genetics in determining long-term health. I asked him to explain the concept of fetal programming.
The fetal programming states that suboptimal conditions in the womb before birth can alter the trajectory, the way the fetus develops, in a fashion that it will affect lifetime health, that issues in the womb will change the function of our liver, our pancreas, our hearts in a way that will be persistent throughout life. And the studies are just overwhelming to support this. Now, babies in the womb have some very clever tricks up their sleeve. If you are short of oxygen as a baby in the womb, you protect your brain. You send most of your blood to your brain. The baby does that. But obviously, it's got to take the blood away from somewhere else. So it cuts down the blood supply to its liver, its gut, and its muscles. It stops moving, but it protects its brain. Now, in the short term, that's enormously clever. But in the long term, it means that you grow a small liver. And indeed, if you look at a growth-retarded baby, an obstetrician tells that a baby is growth-retarded not by the fact that it's 5 pounds. If your genes want you to be 5 pounds, that's fine. The growth-retarded baby is the baby that's 5 pounds whose genes wanted it to be 10 pounds. And you can indicate that baby by measuring the head circumference and measuring the waist circumference. And if that ratio is high, if the head-to-waist ratio is high, that is proof positive that you protected your brain at the expense of your tummy and the organs in your tummy. Now, the smaller your waist girth at birth, the higher the blood cholesterol at the age of 50. So we are not just what our genes make us. We are programmed in some measure, at least, by the conditions we experience prenatally.
Now, mothers through history have always felt that they were eating for two and that they've had to be careful about what they eat. They're very conscious that it's going to affect the development of their fetus. What's new about fetal programming compared to just this general idea that the things you do are going to affect your baby?
Well, I think the real issue is that they're going to affect your baby for a lifetime. And, you know, that, I think, is an enormous quantum leap in emphasis. And I do believe this is a new paradigm in understanding what is important. We can change the health of society much more quickly by more careful attention to pregnancy than we can ever change it by changing the gene pool. This is such an amazing period of our biological lives. The baby, you will never be cleverer biologically than you were as a fetus. You live in one world according to one set of rules while preparing for another world where you'll have to live by another set of rules. It is a synthesis of how the genes work. It's a synthesis of how the environment affects those genes. To me, it is the single most important story in human health.
Could you give us an example of a disease that you think can be traced to fetal development and a disease that could perhaps be prevented in fetal development?
Well, type 2 diabetes and obesity, we have an explosion of type 2 diabetes and obesity now. It's very clear that although everybody's looking for the gene for obesity, the gene for type 2 diabetes, it's very clear from the animal studies that undernourished fetuses are born with pancreases that do not function as well. And then if they live a life of fast food, as too many of us do, that pancreas is going to be much more prone to give up, and that individual is going to be much more prone to type 2 diabetes. In the developed world, it is the poor who are generally fat. In the developing world, it is the rich who are fat. And in my book, I explain how biologists now understand that. Because the underprivileged baby in the womb, again, as I mentioned earlier, has some clever tricks up its sleeve. It prepares for an underprivileged environment outside. If you're a lion cub on the Serengeti plain in your mother's womb and you're short of food in the uterus, that's a pretty darn good indication that there's not much food outside. There's famine outside. Your mother's not making enough kills. So you develop already in the womb what's called a thrifty metabolism. You learn how to grab on to every calorie you can so that when you come out, you're going to survive this adverse environment outside. The only problem is that in the developed world, the undernourished baby in the womb is undernourished because his mother smokes too much, perhaps takes crack cocaine, or in a large and underprivileged proportion of our society, yes, doesn't get a good diet. So the baby comes out into the outside world and there's a fast food store on every corner. Now there's no shortage of food and there's an explosion of obesity. The falasha, the Ethiopian Jews, flown to Israel, born in Ethiopia, probably undernourished in the womb, flown to Israel overnight to a society where food was plentiful, now have one of the highest incidences of diabetes and obesity in the world. So these are conditions that we can prevent if we understand fetal development properly.
Let me see if I get you straight. You're saying that if a fetus isn't well-nourished, it assumes that's because there's not a lot of food outside, and it will be born with a very slow metabolism so that it could preserve and make use of every calorie it gets. But if it's exposed to a lot of food, particularly a lot of fatty food like fast food, that slow metabolism is going to mean that the baby and then the adult puts on a lot of weight.
Exactly, exactly. And we know, just as I mentioned earlier, that you grow a small liver and you can't handle cholesterol, we know from studies with rats that the actual composition of different types of cells in the liver of babies that were undernourished as fetuses is different. They've grown along a different trajectory. They've prepared for a different world, and then we in the developed world fool them by giving them lots of food afterwards.
One of the questions you mentioned you're studying in your lab is premature birth. And I think one of the questions you're asking is, what's responsible for premature birth? Is it something that the fetus itself is programmed to do, to come out early, or is it a response that is coming directly from the mother's body?
Yes, I think that the problem with premature birth is it's almost certainly has several causations, and it's never very clever of scientists or anybody to use the same term, and we're really rather remiss. We use the same term for things caused by from different causations. We now know that probably somewhere between 40 and 60% of prematurity is caused by low-grade infection. There's some even very interesting studies that tooth decay, that bad teeth actually predisposes to premature birth. And that's, of course, a very simple thing to cure. Just go to the dentist before you become pregnant and make sure your teeth are in good order and keep them in good order during pregnancy. How does generalized low-grade infection cause prematurity? Well, we know that in the presence of infection, some of the hormones and other compounds that are produced to combat the infection also stimulate the uterus to contract. So we have to find out about these mechanisms. Some of them could be very easily prevented on the social level, as I say, by better dental hygiene. Others we need to know about how the fetus is stressed and how the fetus sometimes is saying better out than in. There are some forms of prematurity where probably the intrauterine environment is suboptimal because the placenta is failing, that the baby may indeed do better in the neonatal intensive care unit than inside.
Well, Dr. Nathaniels, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it.
Dr. Peter Nathaniels is the director of the Laboratory for Pregnancy and Newborn Research at Cornell University. His new book is called The Prenatal Prescription. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel The Rackets by Thomas Kelly. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Thomas Kelly has been a teamster and a political advance man for the New York City mayor's office. His debut 1997 novel, Payback, drew on those experiences and took readers into the sometimes explosive world of New York City labor unions. David Mamet has written a screenplay for a film version of Payback. Kelly's new novel, The Rackets, takes readers back for another insider's tour of New York City. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
New York City, as its poet laureate Walt Whitman sort of said, contains multitudes, so many layers of history and ethnic groups and neighborhoods that even though it may be the most written about city in the history of the world, there's still plenty of local lore that slipped through its sidewalk cracks. That's the most distinctive aspect of Thomas Kelly's latest novel, The Rackets. It's set in Inwood, the neighborhood at the very northernmost tip of Manhattan Island. So far up, it's an afterthought to most descriptions of the city. Until a few decades ago, Inwood was a solidly Irish working-class neighborhood. Now, it's largely populated by Dominican immigrants. For what it's worth, I have some passing knowledge of the place. An old friend of mine grew up there. Her father owned one of the once ubiquitous Irish bars, and I went to college nearby, at Fordham, where Kelly himself graduated. I might well know Kelly himself. Practically every other guy at that Jesuit college had a name like Thomas Kelly. I think, in this New York noir, my fellow Fordham alum deftly captures the cloistered mood of Inwood, imposed by its geography and by decades of Irish-American insularity. He mournfully describes its once grand apartment buildings, constructed in the boom of the 1920s, now deteriorated, as one of his characters observes, into overworked tenements and airless elder hostels for longtime residents of the area. He escorts readers into its die-hard bars and up to the rocky outcroppings of its dusty parks, where revolutionary soldiers once fired cannon down on the British and drug dealers now hold sway. Reading The Rackets is like going on a pilgrimage to the old neighborhood just before the wrecking ball hits. On the dangerous walking tour Kelly conducts, sentimentality vies with streetwise instincts of self-preservation. Kelly's plot gathers suspense as it goes along, so that by the last 50 or so staccato pages, what at first seems like an atmospheric but workmanlike plot about union corruption and FBI and police department dirty tricks transforms into a doomsday vision of block-by-block citywide warfare in which allegiances keep shifting. The bloodied but unbowed hero of this story is Jimmy Dolan, an Inwood boy made good. Jimmy put himself through college working construction, then eventually landed a job as a political advance man for a Rudolph Giuliani-type mayor. But when Frank Keefe, a thuggish Teamster local president who's locked in an election battle with Jimmy's father, shows up at a reception at City Hall, Jimmy's old street fighter temper bursts through his expensive suit. Under provocation, he shoves Keefe onto his fanny. That fateful push makes the front pages of the New York tabloids, costs Jimmy his job, and sends him on a downward class spiral back to Inwood. Soon enough, Jimmy is back working construction, and along with his old man, dodging the combined extermination efforts of Keefe's goons, the Russian mob, and the last flailing vestiges of the mafia. After one of Kelly's many, many plot twists, which I won't divulge, Jimmy himself becomes the reform presidential candidate for his Teamster local. A seasoned union official gives him this advice about how to write a campaign letter to distribute to the rank and file. Don't be showing off your college skills. Keep it simple. The members ain't interested in your pretty prose. Kelly himself seems to have internalized similar advice in writing The Rackets. Some of the characters and situations here are schematic, and cliché phrases abound. I heard so many pugnacious characters described as thickly muscled, I felt like decking somebody myself. But just when the writing style of The Rackets seems stuck on autopilot, Kelly slips in some quick description or dialogue that startles because it's so real. Like when a former resident of Inwood returns for a funeral and laments, "You can't even buy a mask card at the bars anymore." Or when Jimmy, fresh off a construction site, tells a snooty Manhattan doorman, "Hey, I work for a living. Sometimes that puts you near dirt." The Rackets is a tough New York story. Like the city itself, it boasts plenty of blind alleys full of surprises amidst its wide, well-traveled boulevards.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Rackets by Thomas Kelly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about The Sopranos with Dominic Chianese. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance as Uncle Junior. He also has a new CD. He'll bring his guitar to the studio and sing a couple of songs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.